David Astle on ABC Radio.
Imagine cracking a code that has been defying the greatest minds for centuries. Well, that is the claim of my next guest, who is a mercurial breaker of codes, someone who can look through past the runes, past the so-called mumbo-jumbo and see meaning behind what lies there. And also, we'll be flipping a coin that has got coded language on it. I don't know if you saw that 50-cent coin story that came out earlier this month. I think it was September 2, so it was kind of late last week. There was a code that was meant to last some days, months, years, but a 14-year-old boy from Tasmania managed to crack it in an hour. So there are clearly some people who have the propensity to decrypt. So what are the features of great code breaking, and why are more and more codes, including a statue that has stood in the CIA foyer for many, many years, defying, again, thousands of attempts, suddenly make a lot more sense now? What has changed? We'll be looking at cryptography very, very shortly. It's great to have your company wherever you may be listening, Victoria and Western Australia, or elsewhere right across this great land, and even in Guangzhou in China. Royce, g'day. Or we've even had Marcus in Bavaria, wherever you may be. It is 9:06 in the east, and it's 7:06 in the west. Before we decrypt, let's talk about things that are not written. Let's talk about things that are unwritten. This is a beautiful tune from UK artist by the name of Natasha Bedingfield. This is Unwritten, and shortly we'll be doing a little bit of uncoding. Natasha Bedingfield.
Feel the rain on you. Hi, Zan Rowe here. My award-winning Double J podcast, Take 5, is coming to the screen.
What a banger, right?
I'll ask five extraordinary people which five songs hint at who they are.
It's the perfect song to end this song.
Guy Pearce, Tori Amos, Keith Urban, Tony Armstrong and Missy Higgins.
You didn't realise this is going to be a therapy session, did you?
Take 5 with me, Zan Rowe. Starts Tuesday, September 20 on ABC TV and streaming on ABC iView.
This is David Astle on ABC Radio.
As a maker of cryptic crosswords, I know one or two things about codes and decoding, but I am nowhere in the league of Dr. Richard Bean, who's a data scientist and researcher at the University of Queensland and a formidable cryptographer. To find out a little bit more about that world and also to the claim to fame of Richard a year or so ago, cracking an incredible code, I'm now joined by the man himself. Richard, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me on, David.
I suppose the story that really led us to down the path of decoding and deciphering was the 50-cent coin that came out only a week ago. Tell us about that story itself, about how it was that the 50-cent coin happened to have a code on it.
Well, the Australian Signals Directorate, that's the Australian Government Community Security Organisation, Communications Security Organisation, had a 75th anniversary this year, and they're having a big recruiting program called Red Spice, aiming to expand the offensive and defensive cybersecurity skills. Yep. And so as part of the publicity campaign, they had a big exhibition at the National Museum of Australia in Canberra. And straight after that closed, they came out with this 50-cent coin with these cryptic puzzles on it that they invited the public to solve and submit through their website.
It would, I think that they probably were anticipating that the code would remain in circulation and mysterious for some days, some weeks, but in the end it was solved an hour later by a 14-year-old Tasmanian. That's a story that is just makes my jaw drop, but I'm wondering, is there something extraordinary about that young man, or is there something more accelerated about our code breaking, or maybe a bit of both?
Yeah, well, that's a great achievement.
It certainly is.
Yeah, there's computer software that can help people with this kind of task, no matter what their age. That isn't to downplay his achievement. But the basic codes out there, the basic kinds are substitution and transposition. So substitution is about rearranging the letters in a text. And substitution is about changing text letters for other letters. And transposition is about rearranging text according to a certain pattern.
So let's say buy milk, B-U-Y-M-I-L-K. I was to do a substitution puzzle for that, a substitution code, how would that work for something like buy milk?
Well, you could just rotate the letters one forward in the alphabet. So B goes to C, U goes to V, Y goes to Z, and so on. Yeah.
Okay, and then for the other one you said, which is like a replacement or a rearrangement puzzle, is that right? Transposition?
Yeah.
How would that
So on the coin, one of the texts is written into a 5x7 matrix, and then it's written in rows and it's read off in columns. So that's an example of transposition.
I see. And that's in terms of techniques or in terms of preferences, is there have either of those codes been more dominant in periods of time?
It started out with the Atbash cipher, the first cipher on the coin. It's actually used in the Bible about 2,500 years ago. Transposition, it's been used in World War II, for example, and by the British Secret Service, and it was used in the Nigerian Civil War in the 1960s. So double transposition, so-called applying transposition twice, is still a very strong cipher even in the modern age.
I know that there's also too those, I read my share of spy novels, Richard, and there are these so-called book codes. Let's say that there's a certain book that's referred to, and on page 30 of that book, that would give you what letters to replace or what letters to transpose. Are those sorts of, you know, separate text enciphering happening as well?
Yeah, so that's an example of a substitution cipher. So it might be easiest to use that kind of cipher with a dictionary, because then if you're looking up a particular word, you can say that word occurs on this page in this column on this line. So you can turn any particular word into three numbers. But yeah, there are other ways of doing it so that you really can only solve them. You can do cryptanalysis only if you know the book that was actually used.
Let's turn to something of a mystery that has lasted for 500 or so years. Take us, if you can, to a conference that was happening in Amsterdam in 2019, Richard.
Yeah. So there were these two researchers, one from America, the US, and one from Austria, and they met at a conference in Amsterdam to discuss Middle Ages literature, and they'd one of them, Megan Pioco, had found a book in the British Library. It was a shared notebook of John and Arthur Dee, who were two famous medieval figures, Middle Ages figures. John Dee invented the phrase the British Empire, and he owned the largest library in the UK at the time. And Arthur Dee was a famous alchemist who was his son. He was a physician to the Tsar of Russia for some time. So they'd written a lot of explanations of alchemical recipes in this shared notebook. But one of the recipes was enciphered in a very difficult cipher. So Megan and Sarah wrote a paper for a historical cryptology conference in 2021, and they published the cipher and said we haven't been able to solve it.
And that was a clarion call for someone who specialises in decoding. How did you approach this this conundrum?
Well, by the look of it, it already had the words with the correct spacing. So the first thing to decide was what language was underlying it, so whether it was Latin or English. Mm-hmm. So based on the word length, I guessed that it was Latin, and then I went about generating language statistics for Latin based on Latin books of the time and also Arthur Dee's works that I could find online.
That's really giving yourself a head start there. I'm just thinking what you've done is working out the likelihood of certain configurations of letters and also to the absence of other letters.
Yeah. So what I ended up doing was building up statistics about the frequency of occurrences of six letters. So, one of the most common six-letter sequences in English might be from because, B-A-B-E-C-A-U-S, and it's quite different in Latin. But once you've done that, it's a big aid to solving the kind of substitution cipher that Arthur Dee used. So it's actually called a polyalphabetic cipher, and this is one of the first occurrences of that being used after its invention in the mid-1500s. So it's very interesting from a historical viewpoint. So I went to the conference in Europe this year and explained my findings there.
How thrilling. Congratulations. It's such a breakthrough to crack a code that's been with us since the 1500s of John and Arthur Dee. I'm chatting to Dr. Richard Bean, who is a cryptographer, as you can quite clearly tell, a data scientist and a researcher at the University of Queensland, who did crack that age-old code. It is 20 past 9 in Victoria, 20 past 7 in Western Australia. David Astor with you on ABC Evenings. Richard, as I say, congratulations, a real breakthrough. And I'm wondering, though, is it do you think that would have been possible pre-electronic age, the sorts of calculations you were doing and the sort of statistical analysis? Do you think it would have been capable of being accomplished with the human brain, without, as aside from the help of an electronic brain as well?
Yes. The cryptanalysts have devised a technique for attacking this kind of polyalphabetic cipher starting in about the mid-1800s. And it involves some statistics and looking for repeated patterns in the ciphertext. That's the encrypted text. But this ciphertext had a particularly long key, so it was 45 letters long. So I think people who'd looked at it before weren't really expecting the key to be that long, because typically it's, you know, at most 20 letters. I mean, imagine if somebody these days had a password that was 45 letters long. It's just very difficult to work with.
Just to explain, key we know is something that opens a door, but for something that can open a code or can protect a code, what's the clearest way of grasping what a key means in terms of cryptography?
Yes. So for the substitution cipher, let's just take that. You take a plain text letter before encryption, and you apply the key letter, and then you get a ciphertext letter pops out. And for this kind of cipher, you just use the key left to right, and then when you get to the end of it, you go back to the beginning. So it's a repeating key. And if you want to make it more difficult, then you can have a running key, which is a very long key, or you can have an auto key, which is dependent upon the plain text or the ciphertext itself.
The whole area of cryptography, has it become beyond deciphering? Because we have got the ability now to overlay and even make things more complex by the advent of computers and these super algorithms.
Yeah, there's a famous cryptographer from the National Security Agency in the US. His name's Frank Rowlett. And at the end of the 1970s, he said cryptography algorithms have become so strong these days that they're beyond, a well-designed algorithm is strong enough to be beyond the capabilities of a team of people working with computers. So even 40 years ago, it was known that you could build ciphers that were so strong that would be extremely difficult to solve. So people, when they're analyzing this sort of thing, they look for back doors or side channels, sideways in, instead of attacking ciphers directly.
I know that may have been the case when it was the statue that I mentioned at the outset, the cipher sculpture that occupies the foyer of the, or just out the front, I think, of the CIA building. It's called Kryptos.
Yeah.
That has been decoded in recent years?
Yeah. So this was designed for the CIA's new headquarters building in the 1980s. A sculptor called Jim Sanborn got the commission, and he took a few years to carve out 2,000 letters from a metal sheet, and it got installed next to the cafeteria in the courtyard of the CIA. And he worked with a retiring CIA cryptographer, Ed Scheidt, to design the codes. So it was in four parts, but it took quite a while for people to transcribe all the letters and then bring them out of the CIA and make them public. So it wasn't like today, when text could just travel around the world in a moment. So over the years, people worked on it, but cryptanalysts from the NSA and the CIA, they were the first to have access to it, to break it. Mm-hmm. But then in 1999, a computer scientist, Jim Galogli from California, broke three of the first messages, three of the four messages, and he published his findings, and it was a sensation. And for the last 25 years or so, people have been trying to break this fourth message without success.
What you may not have the thing verbatim there, but what was the gist of the first three messages that were decoded?
Yeah, well, the first message is about art, so it's about subtle shading and the absence of light. The second one is about invisible forces, so about transmitting messages to Langley, which is where the CIA is in America, and decoding them there. And the third message is about Howard Carter discovering the tomb of Tutankhamun and saying, you know, this is what I felt when I was the first person to see this tomb for 3,000 years. So it's meant to illustrate the thrill of discovery that people feel when they crack a code and they're the first person to see something that no one's seen for decades, hundreds of years, thousands of years.
My money's on the cosmos for number four, but you've got to have the right tools and the right mind to crack that fourth message of the Krypton that there that is at the, near the CIA cafe. I'm chatting to Dr. Richard Bean, who's also the man who cracked an IRA code from the 1920s. How did you go about that task, Richard?
Yeah, so I first became interested in Kryptos, the CIA sculpture, like as soon as I heard Jim Gillagly broke it in 1999. And obviously he's a famous non-government cryptanalyst. So together with an Irish historian, he wrote a book called Decoding the IRA in 2008. So they had a stash of IRA enciphered messages from the 1920s and 1930s that were never meant to see the light of day, but the IRA commander from the 1920s passed them down to his son, and they made their way into the University of Dublin's archive. And so over the years, Jim Gillagly was able to break all of them except one message, which he published in that book. So it became a famous unsolved cipher. It was discussed on the blog called Cipher Brain, and it was in another book about unsolved codes. So I thought, well, you know, I'd better try this out with some of my transposition solving techniques. And the reason it was so difficult was that it was quite short. It was only about 52 letters, and it contained several mistakes.
And what did the message say?
It was about gelignite being smuggled into Scotland, basically. Yeah,
I'm thinking the letters of gelignite are quite peculiar and may have helped you in the patterning.
That was a key part of the solution process. I mean, I noticed that when I applied some permutations, that you could see that the letters G-E-L-I-G-N appear, and when I forced those, then I started to see the rest of the solution.
Was it similar than when the Bletchley Park decoders managed to crack the Nazi code? Was it a word or a phrase that really opened the door?
It's absolutely about that. So there's a classic book with the technical details called The Hut 6 Story by Gordon Welchman, if any of your listeners want to read it. But he says, solving enigma without a crib, that means knowing what part of the underlying plain text is like Hamlet without the prince. I mean, you just can't. Enigma would have been completely secure if the Germans had followed communications security processes, but they didn't.
Was it Heil Hitler? Was it actually that message, or was it a forecast? I seem to think that there was a habit within a lot of the communicators who used this repeat phrase that they used as a means of calling into the text.
Yeah, it was stereotyped beginnings and endings. So they say Hail Hitler in the Imitation Game, the film version. But over time, they were able to learn about all sorts of possible cribs. So I solved some ciphers from the Nigerian Civil War that used transposition with a team of people from Israel and Norway. And one of the things we noticed was that, you know, the messages would always begin, with who was receiving the message, and it would always end with message ends. So
you know what, habits die hard, but they can also make a lot of other people die hard as well if you don't get out, break those habits, because that's how codes get broken, as well as the mercurial mind of people like Dr. Richard Bean, a formidable cryptographer. Great to have your, great to get all those stories along the way too, Richard. Congratulations on all the successes that you've accomplished. I look forward to hearing what more lies in store for you.
Thanks a lot, David.
Looking forward to catching up more with Dr. Richard Bean. He's based at the University of Queensland, where he's a data scientist and researcher. And if you'd like to know more, look out for the story of Dr. Richard Bean breaking that IRO code, as well as the alchemy code of John Dee. 29 minutes now until the 10 in the east. That's 29 to 8 in the west. And after the news, Philip Clark on the Nightlife will be with you. Good evening, Philip.
Hello, David.
Where are you taking us tonight?
Well, we've got Norman Swan in the studio who's going to explain to us how you can live longer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, do you want to live longer? That's the question.
Well,
it
depends how long I'm going to get to live.
There are some suggestions that, you know, people could live to 100, 120 easily. No, lots of people live to 100 these days. I mean, not massive numbers, but a fair number, certainly more than they used to. And living into your late 80s now is commonplace. So would you want to live younger? Would you want to live longer? I think it depends, doesn't it? It depends. It depends on a whole number of factors. If we could live younger, longer, would we want to?
Oh, yeah.
That's what
Can
Norman
I tick that box?
Talks about. You know what? You'll get old and grumpy and you say, I've seen all these clues before. they're not doing that one again. They're not doing slip of the lips again. Four letters. No. Oh, come on. I used that 30 years ago.
So. Oh, that's probably right. I do repeat a few clues now. And that's true.
Anyway, Norman's in the studio in our first hour, so keen to have your questions as well. Monday night travel, we're off to Queensland to the Scenic Rim Trail. Mm. And astronomer Charlie Lineweaver from ANU is back after a long break away from nightlife. He's been all over the world. Anyway, he's going to talk to us about the latest results from the James Webb Space Telescope, which just does sound quite amazing, really.
It is amazing.
And I'm going to ask him also. We're going to be landing on the moon in 3 years, they say. I'm just saying, what are we actually going to do there? What is the exact point again? Anyway, we'll do that. Plus, we'll play the Mighty Challenge. You know the drill.
Hey, question for you.
Yes.
What font did NASA use to leave a plaque, an aluminium plaque, up on the moon? There's a clue, in a way, in the selection of font that they used.
Apollo.
Oh, that's a very good guess. It's Futura. It's a nice one for your quiz. That's also nice. Part of
There are so many fonts these days, though. I mean, people invent them, you know, all the time, don't they?
You should have font as one of your categories in the quiz. But not tonight,
Well,
obviously.
I want there to be an international cap on the number of fonts. So
that's a good pun.
See, I... well, yes. I'm stuck on Times New Roman.
Oh, yeah.
There we are.
What did Times New Roman ever do for us?
What did the Romans ever done for us?
Hey, have a great show, Philip.
Goodbye.
See you, mate. That's coming up in 27 minutes. Who's counting? Well, I am. It's 27 minutes. But shortly, do you know what ASMR is? I'll be honest. About 4 hours ago, I didn't know what it was. But now that I do, I want to know a whole lot more. We'll find out very shortly.
Jacinta Parsons.
A secret she'd kept for 5 decades, even when she was in the middle of a hyper-masculine environment of AFL. Danielle Laidley.
I'd seen counsellors and psychologists' wife. I knew there was something a little different, but then the gender dysphoria would then just roar at certain times and the white noise, and it really affects your ability to live. My life was very compartmentalised.
Afternoons with Jacinta Parsons. Weekdays from 12:30 on ABC Radio Melbourne.
This is David Astle on ABC Radio.
ASMR. You get a prize if you can tell me what those letters stand for. I admit openly, 4 hours ago, I did not know what that cluster of initials represented. But having read a whole lot more about what it means, I need to talk to Jess Stanley.